every single employee is somebody's son or daughter, husband or wife, and they're under your care for the 40 hours a week that they're working, right? And so at the end of the day, you're there to take care of them. You're there to help them be the most successful selves that they can be. And I love that because it's, you know, if you're giving to them, if you're growing them, it ultimately serves you and the company quite well. And so to me, that's how I define servant leadership, because when you take that mindset, it comes 180 and supports the organization that you're responsible for managing or leading.
Stephen Bayer, you're the managing partner of Engagency in New York and the author of the book Stickology: How to Build Unbreakable Connections with Employees and Customers for Life. You're a renowned expert in employee engagement, workplace culture, and organizational performance, and you spend years helping companies around the world create workplaces where people feel motivated, valued, and inspired to give their best every day. Stephen, welcome to the HR Future Live podcast. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on practical strategies to energize teams, tackle digital fatigue, and build a culture that truly drives performance and well-being.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Good stuff. Now, you've spent years helping organizations improve employee engagement and culture. As you look back over your years of experience, what would you say, in your opinion, that business leaders fail to grasp about engagement?
Yeah, so I often use the analogy of looking at Velcro and looking at glue. And I feel like there are many companies that are built around Velcro. Velcro is really easy to adhese. It's really easy to conceive of, but it comes apart really easily, right? And glue, on the other hand, takes time. It takes it has chemical reactions that are happening. It will adhese over time, but it will be much stickier, right? And I feel like many leaders and many companies take that shortcut of going for the simple adhesive, and then they're surprised when things come apart, when in the middle of friction or in the middle of hard times, they people peel away. And that could be, by the way, employees or consumers, right? And so I focus on that because I liken Velcro to I've connected with my employee. I liken glue to I've engaged my employee. And we need to get to a level of engagement where people feel a sense of belief and ownership and loyalty. And without that, we lose people, employees or consumers, very easily.
Now, that's a very smart analogy that you've used there. But are you suggesting either or both?
I'm suggesting glue. I really think that
Okay.
it takes that time, it takes that effort
Okay.
to engage employees. I talk often about, and this, whether you're an employee or a consumer, people just want to feel seen and heard and valued. And when they're put into a box and they're told, this is how we do it, where they feel like they're in a toxic culture, or they feel like they're not, necessarily being coached, or they feel like, they're in a non-psychologically safe environment, they're not going to rise to their best. And when you reverse all that, you have people who are creating magical things for your business. But that requires the commitment of glue. That requires real effort. That requires real intentional decisions in how you lead an organization and the culture that you design.
So let's kind of explore that analogy a little bit more. Tell me a little bit more about the components of the glue. I mean, what does the glue consist of?
Oh yeah, no, it's a good question. So, I think that the big part is In Glue, it's about how do you build connections with your employees. And by the way, I in the book Stickology, I talk about both employees and customers because I think they're interrelated. If you have emotionally connected employees, if you have employees who are really, really enjoying their work, taking ownership, rising to the occasion, that is seen by customers, and that is that's not only sticky in that you're going to keep your employees, you're going to keep customers because they feel like they're buying from a place that is it feels right to them, right? And so I think that's an important part. To answer your question, I think it often comes down to servant leadership. I think it comes down to really changing managerial approaches to coaching, right? We there's a stat that I recently came upon that showed that 60% of managers, new managers, fail and are out of that role within 2 years because they're not trained properly. They're not, they don't have the proper training. They don't have the the understanding of how to really get the best out of your employees. I talk about servant leadership, and I relate this to coaching or to managers as one of the most critical things to any organization. Because if you come in as a leader and think that everyone who reports to you is there to serve you, it's all backwards. You are there to coach them. You're there to get the most out of them. You're there to help them rise to the occasion and to be the best selves that they can be. And when you're a really good coach, that's when you start to get that emotional connection with your employees. That's where you start to get them to feel like they want to be there. They want to do their best. They want to explore as much as possible. And that's where you get the glue.
I don't want to assume that everybody has the same view of servant leadership. So give me your thoughts on servant leadership.
Well, look, I've spoken to a number of absolutely phenomenal leaders in the course of well, my work career, but also in writing this book and doing the research. Servant leadership, and so I'll name a few that have really blown me away. Bob Chapman is one who's been really known as he had a quote, which I'm going to get wrong a little bit, but it sums up in my mind what servant leadership is. It basically says, look, that everyone who works for you, I think he under his company, Barry Waymiller, they have something like 12,000 employees. And he said, every single employee is somebody's son or daughter, husband or wife, and they're under your care for the 40 hours a week that they're working, right? And so at the end of the day, you're there to take care of them. You're there to help them be the most successful selves that they can be. And I love that because it's, if you're giving to them, if you're growing them, it ultimately serves you and the company quite well. And so to me, that's how I define servant leadership, because when you take that mindset, it comes 180 and supports the organization that you're responsible for managing or leading.
As you're moving around, are you seeing much servant leadership around, or is it still in its infancy? Where would you say it is in the evolutionary cycle?
I'm gonna put out I'm gonna quantify that, but this is based off of no science. This is based off of my gut of an observation. I would say that probably 5%, maybe 10% of organizations really take servant leadership to heart. And I think that that's, on one hand, you could look at it and say, well, that's depressing because, many organizations are doing the exact opposite and are very hierarchical or very toxic or don't have the loyalty. Or you could say, what an amazing opportunity, because you have 90 to 95% of organizations that could take that on and revolutionize the way that they work. Another leader that I really adore and look up to is Gary Ridge. Gary Ridge, the former CEO and chairman emeritus for WD-40, he says something, and I told him, I said, I find that what I'm about to say is a little bit on the cheesy side, but is so true. He said, look, at the end of the day, under his care, he always looked at it and said his goal was to make happy employees, because happy employees make happy families, and happy families make happy communities, and happy communities make a happy world. And once again, I put that into the cheesy category, but I think it is so accurate. And if, as leaders, we were to look at that and say, how can I impact this person's lives? And by the way, multiply that by everyone who's working for you, it starts to change not only the culture of your organization, but the culture that we live in as a whole, right?
So if we've got so few servant leaders, then what can we do to increase that?
Well, I took a stab at it by writing this book, because I looked at some of the organizations that I think do a phenomenal job. In this book, I tried to look at 30 different case studies and look at companies that are approaching same problems or same issues two different ways. Some that are doing it remarkably well, and some that are doing it poorly, and show the impact. And so I think part of it is just right, educating ourselves. Forbes Best Places to Work has a report on what makes up those organizations, and quantifies the impact it has for organizations that take on the mindset of servant leadership, and some of the other things that I talk about in the book. And there are three stats that really stick out of my mind. And if I was a leader, a manager, a CEO, anywhere in between, these are three stats that I would think about. How can I lock into these and apply these to my business right away? The companies that are really taking this approach have 8 times more revenue per employee than their competitors. They have 1/3 of the turnover than their competitors, and they're outpacing the S&P market by 3.5 times. And so I look at that and I say, gosh, why would I not try to approach a business this way? Because the impact is absolutely magical.
You mentioned the word science just now. Ology implies a bit of a science there. But now, is there a combination of science and art to it?
Well, first of all, I use Stickology because I just wanted to sound smart. Yeah, no, I do believe that, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there are best practices that you can apply to your business to make sure that it's whether you're focused on servant leadership, whether you're focused on coaching, whether you're focused on building really sensational cultures. So there are best practices that you see across a number of companies. And in the book, by the way, one of the things I do in each chapter is I reflect at the end of each chapter on what was done, and I give activities that you can apply to your business, and try out, right? So there's the science part, but I think we could all recognize that every organization, every leader, and every set of employees are unique. And so, how it's done at one company is going to certainly drastically be different than how it's done at a different, or at least nuanced. And that's okay. It's trying to think about how can we incrementally make each of our organizations feel more, feel better, and more engaging, and as a result, build a lot more loyalty and connectivity with the folks who are there.
Now, you also mentioned culture. Who's responsible for culture in an organization?
Well, so it's a great question, and I think I've heard different people say certain things. First of all, I believe it starts at the top, right? One of the things I talk about in the book is that every leader really sets the temperature for the the organization that they're leading. And if you look, I mean, we can all see this, right? We all sit in a meeting here or there, or we're at an event, and a leader walks in the door. How do people react? Is it business as usual? Are people, happy to see him or her? Do people get nervous? Right. So, like, that's the first thing we should be thinking about is from the leadership, what is the tone that they're setting? Right. And I'm a big, as a entrepreneur and a two business owner, one of the, over the last, 25 years, the thing that's always been really important to me is, in my case, running a really flat organization where everyone feels empowered, everyone feels equal, everyone feels as though they can do whatever they believe is the right thing to move the business forward. That's not right for all organizations, but I do notice that when people are together, people are at ease because they feel like they can do that, right? So that's the first thing. I think that then I but it, I don't think it starts and stops at the C-suite, right? I think that one of the next things is that companies that are getting this right, they are building a bench of coaches. And I use the word coach instead of manager, right? We go back to that statistic I gave earlier of 60% of first-time managers failing because they just are not trained properly. The onus is on the company to help the managers understand how they can keep that temperature at the right level. And then I think that the next thing is supporting that with a proper human resources function that reinforces those things. And last but not least, it's up to employees. Employees as well need to be bought in, and when given the opportunity, think about the people who are going to be in your organization. I've always, as a hiring manager, I've always looked at, is this individual going to move the culture forward? Is this person going to fit in with others? Is this person going to support others? It's not just support from the top down, it's support side to side and bottom up.
Now, I always like to give our audience, HR professionals, things they can do. Now, what elements would you suggest they should start inculcating in the organization to kind of create a culture that's authentic and really engaging?
I would first thing I would ask is one of the things I talk about is in the experience economy. And I believe that the experience economy is relevant whether you're talking about inside your four walls or outside to your consumers or customers. And I define the experience economy as really doing a check on how do people feel when they are engaging with your brand. Do they have positive experiences? And I'm obviously starting with employees. Do they have positive experiences? Do they have memorable experiences? Are they going home and talking to their friends and family about it? Are they diving in extra, because it just feels right? I'll give you a great example. Here in the US, we have a grocery store chain called Trader Joe's. It's not gigantic. But they have maybe a few hundred locations. And what I love about them is that they have incredibly friendly crews. They are incredibly playful. They're incredibly available. On the spot, you can ask anyone who's working there where something is, and they will stop what they're doing. They will walk you to the place. They are empowered to open up any products to show you what it is or do that type of stuff. They are well versed on the products because they feel a sense of ownership. And so I think part of and by the way, sorry, one of the statistics that comes with that is that from a profitability standpoint, they are doing 2 to 10 times more profitable than all their competitors. I think doing an audit is the first thing you can do, right? Is what is that experience economy inside your four walls? And maybe even think about how does it relate to people outside your four walls as well, right? And I do think it's important to do the combination of the two, right? We as organizations often work in silos. HR is over here, marketing is over here, sales is over here, but it's all connected. So maybe pick your counterpart and do that audit together and be honest and try to look and see what are we seeing and benchmark it the best you can against competitors and understand where's the room and opportunity for growth and be honest with yourself because we all want to have exceptional organizations. And I think really getting that data is where it starts.
Did I hear you correctly? Did you use the word playful?
I did use the word playful and
Tell me a
one
little bit about that. Yes, because playful almost suggests childlike, but I'm sure you're not referring to it like that.
I'm not. I'll back up by just saying one of the things that is worth mentioning from my work experience is for years I worked in the video game industry. And I think it's so relevant to the way businesses are run today. And I ask often clients or those that I'm just even interviewing, what if work was played like a game? And so what do I mean by that? If you think about great games, there's a few things that really are involved. One is all games have a great deal of exploration. And also just trial and error. And if you mess up, you learn from it, right? It's a learning moment. It's not a failed moment, right? So what if we treated work that way? What if we encourage people to explore? What if we encourage people to try things and say, all right, well, what'd you learn? Let's not do that again. So that's the first part. The second part is games often have a sense of collaboration. Where whether it's with other individuals or be with computer generated individuals, you're working together to solve problems. So I think that's really important. And the last part is really has a sense of reward, right? Is has real time feedback. It has real understanding of where you're successful. What I see often in organizations is we get feedback once a year. We get feedback when we're doing our annual review. Well, I don't remember what my employees did nine months ago. I remember what they did last week or this morning. So how about changing that? Give real-time feedback the way that a game does. And I feel like if we take the analogy of a game, which is playful, which is immersive, which is engaging, and we said that's how we're going to run our companies, it'd be transformational.
I want to move to digital fatigue now because that's becoming quite a problem, especially in the hybrid workplace. Any suggestions for companies to tackle it without compromising their productivity?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm gonna sound like an old fuddy-duddy, and I'm not. I'm just turning 50, but I really believe that our reliance on the digital world and even more and more AI is in some ways harming us rather than helping us, right? I believe that being in person, trying things analog, getting sticky notes on a table on our wall rather, and working together to have conversation is where sometimes we can rise the most, not only in the way that we're working with each other, but in the culture we're building and the trust we're building, and how we're moving forward together. So I do believe that there's value in pulling back from technology. It serves a purpose, don't get me wrong. There's a company, a small company here in the US in Ann Arbor, Michigan, called Menlo Innovations. And it's run by a guy named Rich Sheridan. And Rich has written a few books. One is Joy Inc. and the one is Chief Joy Officer, I believe. And they're a technology company. But they do a few things I think is really interesting. One is they do all their brainstorms and all their notes on sticky notes. They don't use all the hottest software that you can to put thoughts on screen. The second thing they do, which I love and is so unique, is everybody there shares a computer with another person. And they, by the way, rotate every 5 days. And the reason they do that is they believe that getting people together in front of a screen and working through something and catching each other's problems and challenging each other and collaborating is transformational, and it has been for them. And by the way, they get thousands of people and organizations who tour their offices every year because their approach is unique. But I no doubt there's a place for technology, but we can't get lost in the human connection and the human collaboration that is critical when building a culture that you want people to stick with.
We're getting to that stage of the chat where I'm going to throw a couple of rapid fire questions at you. So fasten your seatbelt.
Okay, I'll try, and I'll try to be fast.
Okay. Okay. Engagement or culture, which drives business more?
Engagement. At the end of the day, engagement drives culture, but it starts with engagement. Yes.
Okay. Remote work or hybrid work, which is better for engagement?
A hybrid. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the more that, while I appreciate seeing you on screen today, if I was sitting next to you, I think it would be even more rich experience for both of us.
Okay. And a favorite tool or technique for reducing digital fatigue?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there's nothing, better than a good in-person brainstorm. There's also nothing better than breaking bread together. And quite honestly, something I've always focused on is when you can, is getting your people out of the office and together, because that's when people start to loosen up and think and communicate in new and more special ways.
One word to describe an ideal workplace.
Collaborative.
Online meetings, love or hate?
Hate.
I saw that coming. And a last one. What would you say is the biggest myth about engagement?
That is easy. It takes work. And that's my whole reason for talking about Velcro versus glue. But if you put in the time and you put in the energy, it will stick. But you need to put in the time and the energy. It takes time.
Wrapping up, I always pose the same question to the person I'm chatting to, and it is this. I've learned that experts have things on their hearts that they want to say. What is it that's on your heart that we haven't spoken about that you feel people need to hear?
Think leaders need to put their egos away and they need to think about the people that they're there to serve and know that if they do it well, their people will serve them and their companies well. And that's the top priority for every organization in my mind.
Stephen Bayer, thank you, thank you, thank you for sharing your insights, your experience. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
It's been a real pleasure, Alan. Thank you so much for having me.